streets literally turned red with blood because they were jumping out of the windows. They were locked inside this factory. It was just a horrific scene. And that brought attention to the plight of the workers, but also wealthier women, suffragists, who were, of course, mostly wealthy, middle class, and white, they saw enough of themselves in those young women to be attracted to this particular movement.
This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Follow us on all the social medias and get us wherever you get your podcasts from. You're going to hear a sentence come out of my mouth that you probably never expected to hear on this show. We're going to be talking about fashion today. If you know me in real life, you know that is definitely not a sentence that you usually might hear me say. But my guest today, someone that I'm proud to call a friend and a comrade, has really kind of opened my eyes to how fashion really kind of does relate to worker rights and to the environment. And there's really a lot of in-depth conversation to be had there. So I'd like to welcome to my show, Professor Katarina Sedia.
Hi, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So if you hear an occasional little bit of running around, she brought her dog with her. So our dogs are playing while we're doing an interview.
Yeah, there's a lot of puppy play in the background. So
you know, if you hear a lot of like odd noises or squeaking, that's coming from the puppies. So, yeah, you teach a class on the history of fashion out at Stockton.
Yes, it's called Fashion and Society. And they basically, I am interested in fashion. And I think the assumption is that a lot of people who are interested in fashion, they dress fashionably, but that's not necessarily true. You can be interested in something without necessarily practicing it directly. But I am very interested in fashion. I'm interested in textiles and I'm interested in fashion history. And it kind of came to my attention how much fashion has been this crucible in which so many social movements like women's rights and worker rights, and even some of the technology questions that we're dealing with today have developed. And I developed this class kind of as an opportunity for myself to explore the connectivity between those issues and hopefully, you know, to give my students a bit of a lens through which to approach the clothes that they wear.
Right, because fashion, whether we know it or not, has had a big part in social movements throughout history. And that is something like worker rights and social movements is something that we talk about here all the time. So can you give me a little bit of a background, you know, wrap it up? I know you teach an entire class on this. Yeah. Try to, you know, truncate a semester into a few minutes of discussion about some of those social movements in the history of fashion.
Sure. Well, I guess the most obvious point of reference would be the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, in which a number of young immigrant women who were workers died in this fire because they were locked inside the factory. And that's because they were young women and because they were mostly immigrants from Eastern Europe. They attracted a lot of attention because they were like literally people, those young women were laid out on the street. And streets literally turned red with blood because they were jumping out of the windows. They were locked inside this factory. It was just a horrific scene. And that brought attention to the plight of the workers, but also wealthier women, suffragists, who were, of course, mostly wealthy, middle class, and white, they saw enough of themselves in those young women to be attracted to this particular movement. So that was kind of this bringing together of suffrage and workers' rights. And much of what we see today, what we think about today as sort of the socialist struggle, came out of the aftermath from that particular factory fire. Also, if we kind of look at New York and by extension, New Jersey, Hamilton, where we both are, has this building, Kramer Hall, which used to be a garment factory. And New York garment industry was so vibrant that much of it went into New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and much of it actually has been happening around us. And it was really a huge industry because everybody needs clothes. And at the time, pretty much 100% of the clothing that people wore were manufactured here. And because it was such a linchpin industry, they commanded a lot of respect. And once they started organizing, they had enough power. If they called for a strike, New York City stood still. So there was a lot of power in this movement just because it was all the labor was domestic, right? So it was not overseas. It was all New York City. And it was the industry everybody needed. So much of what we see in terms of the work week, vacation days, you know, and just like not being locked in your workplace when there's a fire, all of those things pretty much came from the aftermath of that thing. And it is kind of a very interesting way of looking at it because, as I mentioned, a lot of the workers, they were immigrants. So garment industry was in a way kind of this engine of also taking the immigrant population who would, you know, work in those sweatshops, low-paying jobs. But as they started organizing, as wages increased, it sort of gave them opportunity to earn a living. And the next generation became middle class, you know, doctors, lawyers, what have you. So garment industry in New York has long been viewed as this way out of poverty and into a middle class. And much of the union narrative that we hear today, with all its limitations, of course, you know, it came from the 50s. It was very white. African-Americans were intentionally shut out of it, and they think it's important to recognize. But for white people, including white immigrants, it was a way of making themselves into the middle class. And if you compare this history to what is happening today overseas, for example, in Bangladesh, where much of the clothing is manufactured, just a few years ago, there was a massive factory collapse, which killed, I think, close to 1,000 people. Rana Plaza collapse. Yeah, and it was the largest industrial accident. And same story, workers locked inside the factory. They were pointing to the management that there were cracks in the foundation, and management said, it's fine. Just go back in and work.
So why were they locking these people in? Just so they didn't leave on breaks?
Yeah, so that they keep working. And this is, mind you, this is the legal garment industry. If we're looking at the illegal thing, that illegal part of it that makes knockoffs of brands, there is even less regulation and a lot more atrocities and violations of human rights. But even in the legal industry, people are basically what is happening right now is because I think a lot of people, they kind of look at Bangladesh and they say, well, the same thing that happened in New York could happen there, right? People will start working those low-wage jobs, you know, and kind of make their lives better, and next generation will be better off. But it's not happening because, of course, look at China. Once China decided that they didn't want to be the world's factory, once they started demanding higher wages, once they started doing things other than just like cutting and sewing clothes, what did the factories go to? Bangladesh, to Vietnam, Laos is another, basically Southeast Asia. So right now what we're seeing is this industry doesn't have the power to improve human condition for the people who work on it, simply because the labor pool is so widely spread. And basically, early 20th century, the labor pool was local and the industry was also localized.
Right now, because of this global economy and because of colonization and imperialism.
And because basically the borders are for people. People are locked in. People cannot move across borders freely. Capital can. And because of that, we basically see that the capital can pick and choose, those factories can pick and choose, and it's all the race to the bottom.
Whenever, there's always another country that they can outsource to if you start to demand concessions.
Whenever they can, like, shave a couple of cents off, they will do so. This is why, like, a lot of times people say, well, how come they don't even have fire extinguishers in those factories? Like, how expensive can it be? And the point is, like, of course it's not expensive, but whatever expense is given to those factories is going to cut into their profits, you know, even in a very minuscule way. And that is kind of enough for them to justify this kind of increased outsourcing and increased demands. And a lot of times, you know, they would come to the factory and say, okay, you can make this garment for 50 cents. I have a place that will make it for 40 cents. So what they're going to do, they will make it for 40 cents or jobs go elsewhere.
Right, right. And something we had talked about a little bit in the pre-interview was, you know, if you bought a shirt maybe 20 years ago, it would be a certain, you know, density of fabric, you know, that, you know, threads in it. And now you go to buy a shirt and you pick it out and you hold it up to the light and you can literally see through this shirt. Like, well, they're literally making them cheaper and cheaper and to be almost disposable. So you'll consume more shirts.
Absolutely. And there is not to say that there is, like, no quality clothes made, but they're going to be more expensive. But consumers get so conditioned that, like, a shirt must cost, like, between $10 and $20 that a lot of people, they get outraged. Like, what do you mean, like, a shirt? How can it possibly cost $50? It's like, well, if you're buying something for $50, whoever made it was probably paid $10, you know, because so much of it is markups and it's like it's not the cost. So, yeah, I mean, it's clothing is expensive if it's made using fair labor. And you're absolutely right about the fabric quality and what is happening with it. The disposable fashion is very much intentional. There was this advertising guru, he wrote a book on the modern advertising, Ernest L. Malkins. And his thing was that you have goods which you use, you know, things like your car, things like your washing machine, and basically any kind of thing that you buy and use for a long while. And then there are things that you use up, like the gas, the dish detergent, the soap, basically anything that you expect to run out of at some point and buy again. And his thing was that the role of advertising is to make things that you use into things that you use up. And this is where built obsolescence comes in. And this is why we expected to buy clothes that, like, they're not going to survive two washes. And nobody complains, you know, because you paid, like, what, $5.99 for this shirt. And it's like, all right, well, I'll just buy another one. And the amount of waste that it generates. And, of course, the fact that if you're buying something for $5.99, you know, it's kind of, it's depressing to think what whoever made the shirt was paid. And nowhere in the world is that the living wage.
Right. And I wanted to kind of go back a little bit about when we were talking about how it's not a path towards upward mobility anymore.
Absolutely.
Is that, you know, in a lot of countries, people are leaving the countryside to come into the cities and work in these factories, and their quality of life might even be decreasing because of it. Like, there's not a lot of opportunity, where there was not a lot of opportunity in the country, but, you know, they worked, set their own schedule and as much as they could. And
If you're interested in this topic further, there is a really good documentary. It's called The True Cost, it's very depressing. But they do have a pretty in-depth look at Bangladesh workers. And what is happening is they oftentimes work in those factories, you know, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. If they have kids, they have to bring them to the factory. And one of the women that they interviewed, like, part of the documentary is actually dedicated to her taking her daughter and shipping her back to the countryside to her parents, because she cannot take care of her in the city. So this industrial lifestyle, I mean, it's not only completely dehumanizing, because, you know, it's not compatible with life. It is so polluting. It is just, like, so focused on generating maximum profit and not at all concerned with human comfort. So it is profoundly anti-life, but it's also makes it pretty much impossible for somebody to have a family under those conditions. So, yeah, it's very much destructive. And I think it is kind of similar to what was happening, say, in London in the early 19th century. It's all very Dickensian, except that, of course, you know, if you look at the Britain's economic recovery, you don't expect the same to happen in Bangladesh just because of that mobility of capital and not people. People can no longer, like, go somewhere and because of job reasons, you know, we do not consider economic migration a human right. We do not consider it a good reason for requesting refugee status. But economic despair is a very real thing.
Right. If someone's living in poverty and there's opportunities, you should be able to follow the opportunities. But
but that would not allow the capital exactly to exploit the workers, because that's the thing. You know, we keep labor pools locked in and capital moves freely in between them, picking and choosing. And that basically people still organize and they do have some modest successes, but big successes are simply impossible just because the deck is so much stacked against people. And again, you know, that's the whole profoundly anti-human and anti-life state of the capital today.
And really, I mean, we haven't quite touched on it yet, but I know something that you're also deeply concerned with is ecology. Mm-hmm. And these are very environmentally damaging practices that are often used in these factories.
Absolutely. And well, there are several layers to it. Layer number one is, of course, a lot of the countries, people oftentimes talk about the lack of environmental regulation in those countries. But oftentimes, you know, environmental regulation does exist, but it is just the multi-billion dollar corporations that bring those jobs in. They can pretty much ignore the law as they see fit. And in some cases, they can even rewrite the laws. I'm not sure if this is indeed the case with the garment industry, which is, by the way, the second most polluting industry in the world after the energy. But in the energy industry, oftentimes when somebody gets a contract to go into a country, oftentimes in Africa, to explore quote-unquote natural resources, they are also, the government literally indemnifies them against losses of profits, meaning that if there is a revolution, if there is a new environmental law curtailing the activity, that the government will have to pay them for loss of profit.
Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of times, you know, you can say basically those people, like, why don't they care about the environment? They may, but they're so hamstrung by this economic imperialism that oftentimes, you know, it is simply not feasible for them.
Right. And there was something else that, you know, it's a term, I don't know if that's the official term for it, but like environmental, like, colonialization. Like, basically, we will put environmental regulations that seem very nice on things in this country, and then intentionally make them where that's not in place. And it's another form of colonialism and imperialism. We're sending our garbage.
And it's the economists have this lovely word, externalization, when you're basically externalizing the cost but keeping the profit. And this is pretty much what they're doing with environmental damage. But of course, it is done not only on the level of production, but also on the level of what happens to your clothes after you're done with them. And a lot of people say, you know, well, I donate my clothes. And H&M, they have now donation centers. You can bring your stuff in. You can get like a little discount on your new H&M stuff. So everybody gets to feel good. But what happens to this donated clothes? And the assumption is that they go to people who need them, you know, locally. But there is much more clothes than there are people who need them. And oftentimes those clothes, they just shipped in bulk to the global south, which is, you know, another way in which this garbage is externalized. And not only it is shipped there, and you may say, okay, it sounds good, people have something to wear, but a lot of those places, they used to have very vibrant local textile industries. Haiti, Nigeria, other African countries, I'm not going to make things up, but I do know that there is a number in which it is an issue. Lagos, incidentally, in Nigeria, actually has become quite a bit of a fashion center. But many places that used to have those very robust local textile industries don't even anymore, because what happens is they get those shipments of bulk Western clothes, they resell them for cents on the market, and local artisans who want to make a living cannot compete with those prices and they go out of business.
Yeah, this isn't the first I'm hearing of this. I know what I was hearing about was shoes and, you know, just donating. They're just basically dropping shoes into an area, essentially, and not like, well, did this area need shoes? Like, they may already had shoemakers.
And that's the thing. You know, you can sort of put anybody out of business if you basically just undercut them with like a ton of cheap garbage. And and I mean, also the sheer volume, even like the most sustainably manufactured garment, if you make too much of it, it will have to go somewhere. And there is a saying in ecology, there is nowhere. You know, everything has to go somewhere. And when it comes to recycling your clothes, well, they don't decompose very easily. And everybody knows that synthetics don't decompose. But natural fibers, your like cotton t-shirt that doesn't rot off your body, right? It's actually pretty resilient and it doesn't actually decompose very easily. It's mostly carbon cellulosic fiber. Even natural fibers take a while to break down. I mean, they do break down, but
It's not an instant, like overnight. You don't throw a shirt out and it's gone tomorrow.
Exactly.
This is still going to spend years, especially in a landfill type environment.
You cannot compost this stuff, no.
And even things that are meant to decompose in a landfill may take exponentially longer than they would if they were just sitting in a wood somewhere or something.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there was, I guess before I get into the what could people possibly do to fix all these bad things that we've been talking about, because we are talking about bad things, is there's also, I think this is something that's happened, I don't know if it's just specifically designers of clothing, where they would rather destroy clothes if they make extra clothing than donate it somewhere.
Yeah, because you want to preserve the brand. Burberry got into a lot of hot water. And now I think that actually they do have a program in which they are donating some of this stuff. But basically, yeah, it's the fear, of course, is like, you know, if every homeless person is walking around in like genuine Burberry, it's bad for the brand. So they'd rather burn it than donate it or do anything else with it. I think that they have repurposing programs. They do have, you know, some recycling, markdown programs. But it is yet to be seen how effective it is. But yeah, brand dilution is sort of a major concern, because if you're Burberry, you know, we talked about, you know, if a t-shirt costs $10, it was not made using fair labor. But if a t-shirt costs $500, it doesn't mean that it was, you know, made by the artisans. A lot of times $500 t-shirt, like you literally are paying for the brand. And branding is a whole other thing that we do talk about when we talk about, you know, not just economic capital, but also the social and cultural capital. And this is why it is so important for fashion designers to oftentimes be seen as artists. And fashion, oftentimes you have the Met Museum having Fashion Institute exhibits every year. So there is like this serious bid for artistic legitimacy in fashion. And part of it, of course, is driven, well, I mean, it can absolutely be art. I'm not arguing with that part. But also artistic credibility, it does translate into a lot of cultural capital. And of course, that allows you to accumulate the capital.
The actual monetary capital.
Yeah, the actual capital, yes.
So was there any other things about specifically about the fashion industry you wanted to touch on before we go into what people can do?
I mean, there is a lot, but I do think that it is worth recognizing that if people are kind of concerned where the clothes come from, we do slag on, you know, technology a lot, but we do have Instagram. And Instagram is kind of, it's a wonderful place to find people who are perhaps independent, who make clothes independently, and who may be making it themselves or doing it in small batches. And if people are interested, you know, in wearing clothes but not necessarily supporting this destructive industry, places like Etsy, places like Instagram are certainly like good places to find somebody who's independent and not plugged into this global thing.
Global exploitation network.
The global exploitation network, GEN.
Trademark New Jersey Revolution right now. But you know, I suppose also, are there some, like, you would be much more knowledgeable, some brands that are a little better than other brands, or is it kind of across the board?
I will say that some brands are worse than other brands. Basically anything fast fashion, like H&M, Zara, anything that is based on very fast cycling through the trends, they are overproducing by necessity. The statistic I heard recently, something like 80 billion garments are sold each year, and the 80 billion garments are sold and bought, right? And that sounds like a lot, but 100 billion are made. So it is designed with like 20% waste in mind. And this is just at the sale point. Those right. are the things that just like don't sell out of the gate. So definitely to say anything with like massive, massive presence, something that is very cheap, probably is not going to be your best option. I wouldn't say necessarily that more expensive things are necessarily more sustainably made, because we do know that even major brands participate in the sweatshop labor, and a lot of them lack transparency. So maybe they're doing everything very ethically. We just don't know. Ultimately, I do think that the best thing you can do is just buy secondhand if you're concerned about this sort of thing. And just wear the clothes that you have.
Worry so much about what's trendy.
And I mean, it's like, and good quality clothes, they will last. Like I tell my students, you know, I have some clothes that are older than they are, and I have some shoes which are older than I am. And, you know, and a lot of well-made things will last you forever. And there are like a lot of really good secondhand shops today online and elsewhere. Swapping things with your friends, basically. But ultimately, I do think that whatever we can come up with, it's really a band-aid. The issue is the global industry that will exist. I was reading this massive report that is put out by McKinsey Institute everywhere, like every year, on the state of fashion. And last year, like, what is going to be the biggest trend? Sustainability. Consumers are demanding sustainable things. You know, it's just like it's in the stars now. Who are the biggest sellers? H&M. H&M, Adidas, Nike, all of those massive brands that we all know and love, athleisure, you know, which are generally not very sustainable. People like to talk about sustainability. They do not necessarily practice it in sufficient numbers. And ultimately, it is not the consumer's responsibility. I should not have to do 2 hours of research before, you know, buying a shirt to make sure that, you know, like, no enslaved children made it.
Right, right. I mean, the real fault here, and I think, you know, hopefully everyone that's listening to this knows, the fault is in our capitalist system where profit is the only motivator.
Yeah, and
that sustainability, it's just because it's trendy is the only reason they're even talking about it now, because there's profit in that.
But I do think, like, as an individual, you know, if you do want to sort of contribute to well-being of people who make your clothes, there are absolutely things that can be done. I mentioned, you know, independent mm-hmm. designers. I'm kind of at the time in my life, like, I'm almost 50. So at this point in my life, I don't buy too many clothes. But when I do buy them, I have friends who make clothes and they prefer to buy from them. Right. You know, it's just like it's harder with things like, I don't know, like athletic wear, like gym wear. But with regular daily clothes, yeah, befriends like somebody who makes clothes and buy from them.
And you maybe don't need as many clothes as you think you do. That, you know, yesterday we were having coffee and discussing that, you know, I may be able to live out my life and not buy any more clothes.
And I think it's true of everyone. And I mean, sure, like younger people, I'm talking to my students, you know, and a lot of them, they do like live in sort of very basic things, but they do realize that when they start looking for jobs, they will have to kind of quote unquote invest into work appropriate wardrobe. And some of them will probably go to secondhand, you know, and find something appropriate. For others, fast fashion may be the only option. And I do think that important thing to remember is you are not at fault. It's not your fault that the world is messed up. And ultimately, it shouldn't be your responsibility to fix it. You can do things to make yourself feel better about your choices, absolutely. And but yeah, I mean, if your only option is to get something from H&M, and again, it's so different from everybody. People, for example, who are who have any kind of mobility limitation, their choices are very limited.
Right.
People who are not straight sized. People who are not regular height.
For those of you that are hearing the huffing and puffing, that is not our guest. That's her puppy roar. That was just breathing into the microphone.
Yeah, I do apologize for my dog's presence. And yeah, it's...
But yeah, it's not, you know, you can make individual choices and it's great to do that. But really, your responsibility, if you want to do something, it's... working to change the system, you know, organizing locally,
finding ways
to meet your needs locally from a local community network.
Yeah, the bottom line is you want a sustainable lifestyle, overthrow capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there is no future for this planet under capitalism, and everything else is a Band-Aid at best. And, you know, sometimes it's not even a very good Band-Aid.
Absolutely. And I mean, it comes to labor rights and environmental justice, which are so intimately connected. And both of those things are... it is kind of very interesting to me because industry is talking so much about self-regulation, and I always laugh, you know, because like self-regulation just works so very well for various things. I think there was an article recently that now the pork industry is going to be self-regulating. Reaction was like from a lot of people, well, I guess I'm not eating pork anymore. And it's like, yeah, that's a sensible thing. Like once you find out that something starts to self-regulate, like, okay.
Well. Right. That means not regulated, essentially, is what that means.
Pretty much. And yeah, and regulation is definitely not the thing that is viable under the system.
Right. The system has to change. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. So that is why I wanted to have this whole discussion about fashion, that it's an illustration of everything that we talk about here, that it's there's no part of your life that all of this exploitation and damage is not touching. Even the clothes on your body. I don't care if you're sitting in your pajamas listening to this right now, that yeah. It's still touching every aspect and you have to wear clothes. Society says so.
That... Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and it is cold out. So
yeah, you might have to wear a lot of clothes right now. We did record this right when the first snow of the year happened here. So you know, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
To my listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. Hopefully, you know, I got you thinking a little bit about an industry that maybe you hadn't given a lot of thought to, about its role in social movements and just how deeply it is connected to everything we talk about here. And you know, I appreciate you guys so much for listening to us. We would not be here if it were not for you guys. And you know, we are here to be the voice of these kind of topics that you aren't hearing on mainstream media. And we do have to keep asking you, if at all possible, go under our website and click on that donate button, www.njrevolutionradio.com. Click the donate button. Even if it's only a couple of dollars a month, it really does help us. You may not think, well, what can they do with $5 a month? But, you know, if we get a few people that are chipping in $5 a month, it really does help. help us pay for those fees. And our fees do add up pretty quickly. So we really appreciate everyone that's able to donate to us. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.